again, in my humble opinion.
Oh, as far as the death trick with the green screen, oh yeah, definitely it's not your humble opinion. It's actually the technique that is being used by photographers and videographers and film industry. So you have a green screen, and I have at home a green screen, and I was experimenting with it, and definitely you can put the green screen any background you want. So yes, you're absolutely right, but it's...
Yeah, I know. I have a couple of green screens, and there's loads of software these days that are either inexpensive or sometimes free. The NVIDIA plugins include a green screen application, so anyone can do it. Everyone does it at one time or another just for giggles.
Yes, but as far as invisibility... we're talking about the frequency in nanometers, the is the frequency of visible light. I believe that at least partially the technology is being used and applied, but mostly for military purposes, not the civil, not the regular market. The next one is, did Pennsylvania just ban using two-way radios while driving? So we have a video exactly with the title, did Pennsylvania just ban using two-way radios while driving? And the gentleman explains what and why and whatsoever, and he says that soon it's going to be in every state. Back to you for your comments.
Well, we'll see what develops. You know, I mean, there are things that bend light. They're complicated and they fail rather easily. And they're mostly in research. I don't think there's any military invisibility screen that's put out on the field these days. You know, who knows? But every time I've ever seen them work on it, it's very glitchy.
Thank you very much for that. So, talking about the Pennsylvania ban of using two-way radios while driving, did you have a chance to look at that video, Dr. Roy?
Yeah, they didn't do a ban on amateur radio. There's a specific, they had a clause that protecting amateur radio, then some knucklehead pulled it out of the law, then amateur radio operators actually complained, and they put it back in the law. So the way the law is written, amateur radios can operate their equipment. Other people can't, but the amateur radio operators can.
Yes, indeed. They do. So it means you can still drive and operate radio, but we have to remember that the changes sometimes are not widely announced, so we have to just keep in mind that it may change. But once one state did something, other states may go for it, like it was with medical marijuana whatsoever. But anyhow, we can do nothing about it. Ham radio is nothing that can stand against commercial application of ham radio bands or whatever regulation they want to have. That's why we had that delete, 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 and hopefully it's not going to be as bad for us. Back to you.
Well, I'm having a parallel conversation in the chat room just about that. I don't know. You don't know. We don't know. Like I said, we live in very, very problematic times. So I wouldn't be incredibly amazed if they just kind of delete all of Part 97. I don't think so, but nothing happening these days particularly amazes me.
WS to us.
Yes, Paul.
I must have doubled, as in I didn't get through before. Yeah, I saw that video. It looked like toward the end he was looking or hoping that GMRS and Family Radio Service, he thought maybe he'd be able to use that in a car if he has a ham radio license. But he had his doubts at the end. So do I think, you know. So that's one of the things he was trying to push toward the end. He was conflating the two topics. Back to you, Ron.
Well, I don't know if he was conflating them or a degree of wishful thinking or to kind of use amateur radio as the sharp end of the stick to kind of jam the rest of wireless communications into being allowed to be used. I think it was more of that. And I don't know. I mean, I'm thankful for small miracles. So the fact that they were able to rationalize allowing us amateurs is great. I don't know if you could make the same reason behind GMR. Maybe. I don't know. I guess you'd have to try. I don't think it has the numbers that we have, even though a lot of our licensees are somewhat inactive.
Yeah, okay, very good. And he was also saying that you should have a copy of your license with you, but I was under that impression for years now that we should always have a copy of our license if you're operating mobile. You know, just to be safe and sorry, no matter what state you're in. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I think it's relatively easy to do that. I mean, in addition, especially for New York State, what was usually recommended was carry a copy of your license and also carry a copy of the statute that specifically gives amateur radio operators the ability to operate. Now, my guess is 99 out of 100 police officers that stop you will not care. They will not read it. They will not care. But, you know, you never know. You might meet that 1 in 1,000, or you could at least tell the court that you submitted that information when you got your ticket. But I would include both. In addition to your license, especially when you're driving around in New York State, you know, get a copy of the statute and have it available as well.
Yeah, very good. And, yeah, you know, that's just one guy from one state. You know, there's probably a video for all 50 states. I wouldn't be surprised. But, yeah, he did a good job. I mean, he reviewed the whole thing and all, but I don't think it's groundbreaking news. Back to you, Roy.
No, like I said, I mean, New York State has an out for hams as well. I mean, you know, you require eternal vigilance because there's always some smartass in the state capitol who wants to make a name for himself by erasing some parts of a law for no apparent reason. So you got to be watchful. But as long as you're watchful, fortunately, there are still enough of us around who are able to yell and scream and jump up and down so that we're heard. You know, unfortunately, I see the demographics and such, and there will probably come a day where there won't be that much political power behind us. But enjoy it while we have it.
Yeah, I like the good old days when I always told the story about working a truck driver, and he's flying down, you know, the interstate. And we're working CW back and forth. He's got the thing attached to his leg, and he's sending CW as he's driving, you know. What would a cop think today? Anyway, back to you, Ron.
I would love to know. They probably think that he was an enemy agent working for the Iranians.
Very, very good. Yes, I concur. I guess we'll listen to Wes again. Back to you, Roy.
Okie doke. Back to you, Wes.
Okay. Can magnet deactivate RFID chip? So the subway card or credit card with this trip, or hotel card, or RFID card in form of key fob or card. It stops working and you cannot use it. And they will think, what is the reason? So I thought that this information might be helpful to some guys, especially when you are working to your offices and for some reason you find out that your card doesn't work and you don't know why. RFID proximity cards are this, it's actually a coil. So if you look at it inside, there is nothing, it's a coil. So if you have the AC if you have electromagnetic field around the card, coil is accumulating certain amount of that energy, and a coil is connected to the chip, and then that energy is used to activate the chip, and the device is transmitting back. It's simple like that. So RFID proximity cards are mostly immune to magnets. So if you have a magnet like a refrigerator magnet, it's not going to do any harm. And strong magnet, even though that what I was reading about it, it might hurt, it might not. So what is the problem? I spoke to the guy who bought a Cybertruck. So you have a magnet, and the magnet is in a steady position, so what? But if you try to move the magnet, then you are creating a certain potential in that coil, in that card, or in that key fob. And you're destroying the chip. And he said, I had two cards. One stopped working and one didn't. But the problem is that when I look at how this card was built, one side of the plastic was metal. And right now, Tesla also has a special card to open up the door that looks like a flat card, and they call it magnetic, the metal card. No, it's just a part of one side of it is metal and the other one is plastic, and there is a chip, so it's nothing special, but it is bigger because I believe Elon Musk wants to have everything bigger and everything flashy. But anyhow, if you have electric motors in Tesla, then your cars might be damaged. So keep it.
guess they stepped away. I distinctly heard a call sign, but he was doubling with you, Paul. Wesley, back to you.
Okay, dinosaurs. So the modern form of dinosaur is a bird, and the email was sent to you and Paul. The question actually to Paul is, was powered messing up with Australian rocket delaying its start? So we're talking about rats. But instead of rat, we have a parrot, with bird, that is doing exactly the same job with wires. Paul, your comment, please.
Was that the one with the bird with the cockatoo? Is that the one you're talking about? Which, of course, all somebody did was take a picture and try to make it look like the bird could have caused a problem. Is that the one you're talking about?
That is correct.
Oh, okay. Well, of course, that had nothing to do with the problem. What they did there? They scrubbed the mission. It's a new rocket, new launch complex in Australia. The rockets, it's an Australian product. Looking forward, to seeing it make it to orbit. But that was a hype story, I think. And I read about it when it was scrubbed. In fact, I reported that on the SpaceNet report when that did happen a while back. Back to you.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. So there was Gilmore Space Technologies, and yes, they scrapped the start because of a bird. Interesting, that can only happen in Australia. And the last one, Microfactory. A robot that automates repetitive manual work, starting with electronics assembly. So, there was a very nice looking round face and quite bold gentleman with very much oval body, with a somewhat familiar to me facial expression and characteristic build, around 4 years old, with strong Russian-like accents. During 1 minute present a device that looks like the assembly of two robots helping each other, one on the left and one on the right. On the right of the 4 by 3 feet transparent box having front walls removed, the device automates repetitive manual work starting with electronics assembly. Those robots look like they are made from unknown plastic, quite possibly rigid, to some point beyond which it might not be rigid any longer, if it was rigid at the first place. The gentleman from the video named the device Autonomous Microfactory, and the video suggests that such a machine allows you to make assembly of elements at home in form of production. So you can make money on it. All you need is to have such a device at home. Let me drop. Okay. So, not new at all, but quite catching, because I'm into CNCs and into automation, into machinery, into metal. So late meals and whatsoever, I was working on all of this. But not new and quite eye-catching is the addition of hand grip, allowing you to perform manually all operations that are then memorized by those two robots and then repeated. So you teach robots once, and then they can repeat whatever you did with that manual grip. All of so it's not much of the programming, but they only presented one grip, so one robot can pick up, let's say, the screw and pass it to the second robot, or one can hold soldering gun, one the other one may place element on PC board or hold the soldering wire on it. But the problem is that you need two hand grips to teach each other together. And if and for me it looks like a complete BS. I'm not saying that that's because of that heavy, strong Russian accent. No, absolutely not. No, I love Russian. Yeah. So the web page was shown on that video, localhost 5173. No name or no contact information, but there was a clearly shown simple automation web page with the logo on it, of course, without the address. And all those guys needed is from you is your first name, your last name, your address, and they attach you could search for them because of that name, and then eventually it gives you some addresses, Los Angeles, and some number that you can call to with plus in front of it, which says that it's international number as well. So you could probably get a nice gentleman from Russia calling you and asking you for money. And Dr. Roy made, so if you think that those nice, quite possibly far Eastern European, Euro-Asiatic presenters can help you, you may give them a call. Knowledge of Russian language helps a lot. And Dr. Roy made a comment, so Dr. Roy, back to you.
Well, it's a grip. Matter of fact, you can pretty much tell there's a short scene where their automation is threading a needle, and you can kind of tell that actually it's in reverse, pulling the thread out of the needle. So it's I'd give them a C plus, a B minus on a good day, but it's a grift.
Yes. So if you love to spend much your money with Russians, so you may do so and think about some production where your manual work will be repeated by two plastic robots probably made in China, assembled by some Russian guy, and eventually some software that is easily available online altogether that you could do by yourself. But at least you get something from them with no warranty that it is going to work, or no warranty at all. Thank you very much for the time given to me, Dr. Roy, and the audience. Back to you, Dr. Roy, and to HG.
KC2GS, thank you very much, Wes, as always, for your participation and all these interesting topics you brought to us today. Thank you. We still got some free time if people have any questions or comments or topics that they would like to roll around. So if there's anyone out there with any of those, hit that push to talk and give us your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Do you know anything about the substance that's in these electric microphones, you know, it stays charged, like, forever, you know? It's not a magnet. Magnets, you know, do that. But for some reason, you wind up with this electrostatic charge in the mic, you know. And then, that's how they work. You know, other mics, like regular condenser mics, you know, you need a, they call it a phantom voltage or something to drive the condenser mics. But, you know, for the ones that don't need it, they have that electric stuff in it. You know anything about the material? I mean, does it, you know, how do they set it up? How do they make it? What's it made out of? I was looking up yesterday, but I got sidetracked, and I haven't finished investigating it. Back to you.
Oh, okay. There's a lot of different types of dielectric that have that quality. It's kind of similar to the way that ferromagnetic materials can have magnetic fields kind of imprinted or frozen into them. There are some dielectric materials that can, when they set, can set with the electric field kind of frozen within the dielectric. There's a whole bunch of different ones. If you kind of look up Wikipedia, they probably have a laundry list of them. But they're you know, special dielectric insulating sort of materials that when they form, they can have the electric field frozen inside them. And in the same way that it's what you do with the frozen electric field in the dielectric and not the energy trapped in it that you use to work the microphone. In the same way that a ferromagnetic magnet has the magnetic field kind of frozen in its domains, and it's not necessarily the field that's frozen that does all the work, but moving around the magnetic field that does all the work.
Yeah, you start moving the coil in there, and you're going to generate a voltage, and, you know, it's going to work, but, you know, you need that electric stuff to make that work. And I got as far as finding out, like, this stuff has been around for, like, decades, you know? It's like nothing new. And I just never, you know, thought about it all these years. And it's amazing, you know, some things I take for granted. Back to you, Roy. Thanks for that.
You're welcome. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things under the surface that we don't hear about, so we don't really know about, and it doesn't really get brought up in a conversation that there's electric charges that kind of get frozen in place, and then by manipulating that frozen electric field, you could do all kinds of interesting things. Most of our environment either has a moving current, or we occasionally get static electric fields that usually just give us a shock when we touch our doorknobs.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the one article I was reading was about the phantom voltage. It had to be like 40, I think it was 48 volts. It seems like a lot, you know, and you know, you don't need that with the, you know, with this electric microphone, you know, this whole process that, you know, that all amplifiers had, and, you know, if you plug a condenser microphone in, it would work as long as you, well, sometimes it was a button on the mic to enable that voltage or disable it. But all that could be eliminated or is eliminated with the dynamic electric microphone. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic and electrolyte have different qualities. They have different gain. I think the 48 voltage phantom is more of a historical artifact that back when phantom power was first conceived of, you know, voltages all ran high. I'm sure if the industry wanted to, it could shrink down usable phantom voltages to just a few volts. these days. But because of its history, it started 48, and no one's really going to change it at this point.
Yeah, okay. The history of the microphones, it is a good topic, you know. All my radios, you know, are all really electric microphones. These things are not, you know, that's what we use. Although I was reading that you could, let's say you get the Heil microphone, and that's different. And you could hook that up to your rig as well. But I don't have that. Anyway, back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I kind of have mic elements for both. I have condenser and I have dynamic. I have two lightweight headsets. So one is Electret that I use on my ICOM 7100, and the other one is dynamic that I for the most part use for my computer because I can kind of do anything I want with computer input signals. So I remember the very first microphone I figured out what was going on when I was a little kid. Thankfully, my father let me take apart a telephone, which most people weren't able to because no one bought telephones back in those days. You leased them for the rest of your life. But I was able to take it apart, and I discovered that the microphone was a carbon granule microphone, which was a common technology back once upon a time.
Yeah, that's true. I remember taking them apart as well. Yeah, so as you talked, you were increasing or decreasing the density of the carbon. You know, so you created a variable resistor. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it varied with the frequency of your audio as you yelled into the damn thing. And it was a little on the scratchy side, but it worked.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I took those phones apart, too. Played with the dialing system. Trying to remember what we did. I had a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and if you dial, you know, what I would do first is dial a number. Let's say in those days they had the weather, you could where you dial the word nervous. So, you know, you just dial that, and all those clicks were recorded on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Then I take the tape recorder and then feed it back into the phone system, you know. You know, the two wires, I think, was the red and green wire. And hook the speaker output to that, and then find the tape, reel-to-reel tape, put it on play, and the thing would, you know, transmit the same, you know, voltages, you know, 3, 4, you know, whatever it is. And I was able to... you know, dial a number, you know, like all of a sudden the weather would come on. It was a lot of fun. A lot of work, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, I used to like that part of the telephone, too. I remember I got a magnet out of it as well. There was a lot of enameled wire. There were all kinds of fun things in the telephone as I took it more and more apart. It was fun, the good old days. Most of the time, those days, I never really put back things. I just kept on dividing them over and over again until they were at a point where you couldn't split them anymore. I mean, I've told a story before that I once was very curious of what was inside of a transistor case. So I took some pliers and I popped the case off, and I saw these fine little wires connected to a grain of it looked like salt, and I was totally confused.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I have a good way of learning. What do you do today? Get on, put it into AI or Wikipedia or something, I guess. I, you know, I guess a lot of people have done this, probably a lot of hams, you know. But I wound up keeping an old dial telephone, one that hangs on a wall. And to this day, I put it into the basement. And it still works. I can still dial out on it. But it's, you know, fun thing to have, you know. Anyway, back to you, Brian.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. I was talking this morning on the 10-meter net about the Sussex ham show. And once upon a time, I was at the Sussex ham show, and I saw this guy who had an old-style ringer, a telephone ringer. In other words, it had a little generator, and it was connected to a relay with some bells. And, you know, it's how the old-fashioned telephones would get rung up. You'd crank the little generator, and it would send a signal to the other circuit, and it would ring and such. And the guy had a sign next to it saying, "This is not for sale." So it was just the way that he set it up to get his attention if you wanted to buy something else on his table. So it fascinated me. So when I went home, I went over to eBay, and I did a search, and I found a guy actually who lives in Manhattan who refurbishes these things. So it was reasonably priced, so I bought it off of him. So somewhere in my house is one of those little crank bells with a generator and a bell that rings.
Okay, yeah, right. You watch all those really old movies, and the guy walks into the general store or something, and he turns the crank real fast. One of those, I guess. And what is that doing? Why are they turning that crank?
It's the power generator to activate the solenoids to ring the bell. That there's someone who wants to talk to you on the other line. And, you know, if you ever see the movies, occasionally they did movies where they featured the operators for some reason in the plot device, and you could see it was a row of quarter-inch phone connectors that were hooked into each other. And the operators would manually disconnect the phone connector and plug it into another port on their switch rack.
Hey, oh, yeah, that I'm familiar with. But when you crank the generator, that's sending a signal, and somebody else's bell is ringing. Where is that signal going to? Is that going to the operator with all the quarter-inch plugs?
Yeah, exactly. It all had to be done manually way back at the beginning. There was no automation back then.
That is so cool. Very good, Roy. Back to you. Nothing else to add here. Back to you.
Okie doke. We have a gentleman on the chat room who says a tone circuit controlled by a rotary dial of a telephone used to dial 1 for a nickel, 2 for a dime, 5 for a quarter, and the coil spring had to be tightened to match the drop speed. Later, the phone company turned off the microphone when a coin was dropped. Yeah, and later on they had tones for that, and then people discovered the two-tone signals for the trunking lines for long distance and to return coins, and that was the days of the blue box that a lot of famous people broke the law as teenagers. Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs, had a little business on the side selling blue boxes before they started Apple. Anyway, this continues.
I'm reading the article on the chat.
Oh, okay. Yes, Wesley?
Yeah, if you finish, I have another subject. Okay. Research is from Johns Hopkins applied to physics lab in Lower Maryland. I'm applying quantum mechanics to biology to better understand nature's biggest mysteries, magnetosensitivity, and organism's ability to sense electromagnetic fields, and use it as a tool to adjust some biological processes. So I came to that by simply reading a nonsense of quantum biologists about the use of magnetic fields at 7 megahertz, and actually was like a deja vu. I recalled Dick talking about Long Island village that was protesting against the use of electromagnetic waves because they didn't understand that 7 megahertz cannot possibly be harmful for any frequency of HF. So if you could say a few words about ionizing radiation and radiation, electromagnetic wave from that standpoint, and eventually go to magnetosensitivity of organisms. I do not recall any mammals or human animals having ability to sense electromagnetic magnetic field of the earth and orient themselves or use it, but you know better. In addition to that, there was another paper, Magnetic Field Effects in Biology from the Perspective of Radical Pair Mechanism, and that says that sensitivity to weak magnetic fields is abundant throughout biology, as discussed in number of review articles. So you could say a few words in that perspective, starting from what frequency is harmful, what is not. That would be like recalling Dick conversations and eventually move to whatever I said in addition to that.
Okay. Below UV. Electromagnetic radiation pretty much only produces heat. Doesn't have enough energy to pull off an electron from an atom. So it's non-ionizing. Now, the UV light isn't actually ionizing, but it does break up molecules and produce radicals, and radicals can break up other molecules. So although UV light is not inherently ionizing, it is destructive to DNA and other organic compounds. When you get past UV into X-ray, gamma rays and such, they're ionizing. So they basically rip the electron right off of the atom and screws up the molecule, can disrupt DNA, can cause mutations and all kinds of problems. So the only thing that below UV does is heat things up. And if you walk out on a sunny day, you're being heated up by electromagnetic radiation. So chances are most devices, you know, unless you're next to a transmitter of a kilowatt or something, you're not going to get that much of a heat dissipation that's going to cause any serious problems. As far as being able to detect, you kind of smeared a whole bunch of things. There's magnetic fields, there's electric fields, and there's electromagnetic fields. And although they're very, very co-joined, they're different things. Electromagnetism is you know, light, and obviously organic organisms can sense, detect, and do all kinds of fun things with light. But it has the range, you know. There's certain light that the human eye can, the retina can detect, and there's a lot of other electromagnetic spectrum that can't be detected with the material that we're born with. need to be supplemented with external equipment. Or I saw recently an interesting article on people working on sophisticated contact lenses that give you a bit of the ability to be able to actually see UV light. You can't really focus them well, but you can, you know, they create a halo effect. So that's interesting. We'll see how that works out. With magnetic fields, some creatures can detect magnetic fields using different methods. They're not all the same method. Human beings, as far as I'm aware, cannot detect any kind of magnetic field. If you apply a very strong magnetic field locally and you move it around, because we have a lot of conductors in our brain, you can induce another electric current, and those can misfire neurons and give you seizures or all kinds of God effects nonsense. So we are somewhat sensitive to extremely strong moving magnetic fields. So that's about all that I have on the subject.
And you could say how could possibly bees and some insects sense their position using Earth magnetic field, and human animals cannot do that, or any kind of mammals do that. Of course, humans are mammals as well. Back to you.
Well, because evolution works in mysterious ways, and very often significant genealogies lose traits that are not necessary for their survival. Insects have four different color detectors. We have three, and a lot of mammals just have two. So it's not uncommon for large groups of living organisms to just evolve and lose traits. We have lost the ability to synthesize a lot of different amino acids that are necessary for our survival. But because we live in an environment where fruits and vegetables and animals and such that we eat supply us with those amino acids, we thrive. We don't need the ability to synthesize it on our own. We steal it from other creatures. So it's very common for traits to disappear, sometimes to redevelop, using different methods entirely, because some species' survival depended upon the development of that, but not necessarily using the same pathways. So, you know, evolution is a higgly-piggly type of a thing.
And to experience. So it looks like in the process of evolution, humans, all other mammals, they had ability to sense magnetic fields of the Earth and orient themselves, and right now they are not. But birds, who are actually modern form of dinosaurs, they still can travel from one place to the other, and their migration actually stands for their ability to orient themselves without devices that you use in form of GPS.
Okay, but you know, it's not necessarily that everyone began with a full toolbox. The toolbox changes. It grows, it shrinks, it grows. There really no evolutionary survival need for location before migratory animals evolved into being. So my guess would be that the progenitors of early mammals didn't necessarily have built-in geolocation. It might have developed in, you know, different branches according to their needs. But, you know, you don't kind of pop into existence with everything readily available. You know, you pop into existence with the bare minimum, and then you build on that over eons.
Okay. So, in other words, you say that this branch of organisms that evolved to mammals didn't have a need to use geolocation, and that's why they lost it. But if you look at the history of the Earth and the creatures that were there, then we see adaptation of dinosaurs in different forms, either flying or swimming or being underwater or being on land, to adjust to environmental conditions that they had around back to.
Yeah, I mean, for different groups. I'm sure that there are fish that migrate, and so they have some form of geolocating. You know, they can find the place that they spawned from, you know, after many, many years. So, you know, there's a lot of different migratory animals, but there are animals that aren't migratory, and they really, it serves no particular purpose. If you expend energy with a system that you don't really use, you're wasting energy. And so in order for optimizing your survival, most likely it'll evolve away from you. You're not migratory animals to begin with. So it's a push back and forth. And again, sometimes species will kind of regress and then kind of go forward. You know, you had sea animals, and then they came onto land, and then some of them decided to turn around and go back into the sea. So you have a case of where they had to kind of de-evolve into things that were more effective for ocean traveling than land traveling. So, again, evolution is incredibly complicated. And making sense of species and clans and all kinds of things, and it's still often up to question. Ultimately, you know, it used to be more of a anatomy question. You basically had fossils with bones, and you might be able to dissect the animals, and you classify them according to their anatomical aspects. Nowadays, you have genetics. So you could do a much finer investigation of what's related to what and, you know, how the genes have changed and shifted and mutated and shuffled around and multiplied and divided and broken in half and all kinds of fun stuff. It's a fascinating field.
Indeed it is. And the last thing, I spoke to the ham radio operator, and he was telling me about telepathy, so I was trying to explain to him nonsense of that BS. And I thought that it would be good if I bring that subject to the TechNet so he could say a few words back to you.
I'm not sure what the subject is.
Telepathy, I'm not sure if I probably pronounce that word, telepathical way of communicating back to you.
Okay, yeah, telepathy. Telepathy is very popular in science fiction. There's a whole bunch of science fiction stories. Star Trek is full of telepathy. Vulcans can mind meld. They touch their fingers to your forehead, and they merge minds, and others are more distant telepaths. There's no indication that anything like that exists. You need a means of transmission. What's your means of transmission? You don't have an RF generator. You know, what are you exactly exchanging wirelessly with two people? So is it possible to kind of fudge around and figure out with some electrodes right over your skull by kind of interpreting electrical potentials of your brain and trying to figure out what you're thinking about? Maybe. Probably not to a very high degree. Probably much broader thing. But do I believe that people just concentrate and can project their thoughts to the next guy across the room? No, I don't think so.
And to exchange. absolutely agree with that. It's a nonsense science to reject telepathy. It's a science fiction. It doesn't exist at all, never existed, and will never exist. There is no means of communication, but people try to interpret probability factor of things that happened, and eventually it might happen that somebody think about something and the other person thinks about the same, but there is no way to confirm if that happened or not, you know.
The closest you can get to it is body language, which is a very inexact pseudoscience. You'll see a lot of that on YouTube as well, where guys will show you some documentary video of Prince, the one who hung out with the pedophile. And, he's been interviewed and made a farce of himself. And you'll have body language people saying, well, obviously, by the way that he shifts his eyes towards the left, it's indicative of such and such. And by the way that he crossed his arms at that point shows that he's being very protective of himself because he feels that he's in danger, yada, yada, extra, extra. Sometimes people who know each other well can kind of interpret gestures and little facial expressions reasonably well. But just to generically, you know, write a book on how to be able to read everyone is another grift.
And at the end, few words about another BS, because we're talking about myth. So BS about anti-gravity and BS about perpetual motion.
Okay, well, perpetual motion violates the laws of conservation of energy. And possibly the extremity of the universe violates the laws of conservation of energy, but you need something relatively as large as a universe in order to violate it. So most of these guys don't have a universe of their own, so they can't really violate that. So that's perpetual motion. What's the other one you asked?
Anti-gravity.
Oh, okay. You could have forces that oppose gravity and locally neutralize gravity, but you can't shield anything from gravity because gravity, as far as we understand right now, is just an aspect of space-time itself, the very fabric of everything we're embedded in. So there's no way to divorce yourself from space-time, and you'd need to do that in order to block gravity from happening. So there's no such thing as reverse gravity or gravity shields. There are different forms of force that can oppose gravity, but that's the best you can get. Unfortunately, like science fiction, there is no faster than light technology. There's no warp drive. There are no wormholes that are viable. They're very theoretical. And when you get down to the very nitty-gritty of them, there's some aspect of the theoretical wormhole that shrinks down to smaller than the diameter of an electron, which is a lot to say because electron is a point source. It's a dimensionless charged object. So all these things sound nice in science fiction, and they let the plot go along. So I go along with it for the sake of a fun story. But ultimately, unless we're missing something really important, you just can't travel faster than the speed of light, and you can't block gravitational forces.
Okay, interesting. And physics is based on models. And that gentleman with another gentleman, Henry Yarmacher, used the word belief. Physics is not based on belief.